You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respects to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh yeah.
Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your hands.
Good morning. You're on 3CR Breakfast, Wednesday, where are we, the 19th of March?
Good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
You've got
19th of March. Yes, you're spot on. Thank you, Sonia.
Yep. Wow. And we've got, who have we got in the studio this morning?
Nita is here in the studio today.
And Jesse is here.
And Martin.
Yeah.
Morning, Martin.
Nice.
And Sonia.
And me, morning, Sonia. Yes, Sonia. Good morning. Yeah, Marty said my name earlier.
Oh, yes.
thank you to Earth Matters for the show. And it's a show that segues nicely into our first interview this morning. Because they were talking about the importance of getting out and voting, particularly putting candidates who rank climate highly on your ballot. But we're going to be talking with Eddie Kowalski from It's Our Voice for our first guest, and they're going to be talking about democratic initiatives beyond elections, not undermining the fact that yes, we do need to get out there and vote, but also that there are, it's important to engage in other ways and to build that democratic muscle between elections and in addition to elections.
And, I suppose it's not just around election time, is it?
Exactly. Who's up second?
I think that's a interview with the
Marcus.
Oh, that one's later on, yes.
Yeah.
The Marcus one. So I will be speaking with Marcus Rubenstein, who is a journalist, has worked across many different outlets as well as in politics, but is currently a editor or the writer of the China Media Watch, basically, for Pearls and Irritations. So he's got lots of interesting things to say about the way that our media covers issues regarding China. Yeah.
And then at around 7:45, we'll be talking to Brad Homewood, who's an Extinction Rebellion activist who spent time for protesting. And he's going to be one of the speakers at the Defend Dissent protest, which is on this evening, 5:30 today at State Parliament. And just in case you've been under a rock, the reason why this protest is being held is because the Premier has proposed a number of measures, including, and I've got a list here in front of me, a ban on wearing masks, which prevents protesters from being COVID safe, restrictions on symbols of resistance, including flags and tools such as locks, ropes and glue, which is essential for peaceful civil disobedience. A requirement for multicultural orgs to sign a social cohesion pledge. Now, I wish some of the politicians would do that. And the creation of so-called safe zones around religious buildings, which would make most of the CBD off limits for any protests in the first place. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we'll be talking to Brad about the introduction of those measures and encouraging you to get down to the State Parliament this afternoon.
And then after that, we'll go to the second part of a multi-part interview I did with Sasha Gillies-Lukakis, who is an incredible, all-knowledgeable source on everything Latin America and also the co-host of the Latin American Update and Unitarian Half Hour programs here on 3CR.
And I think that should do you for this morning.
That's a lot to fit in before 8:30.
Yep, hopefully we'll get everything in. I'm pretty sure we will. But first off...
the news headlines.
News headlines. Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now. One, two, nitty gritty now, yeah. In the news headlines for Wednesday, the 19th of March, 2025... first, a landmark decision on native title law has been handed down by the High Court in Australia. The High Court of Australia has handed down a landmark judgment on native title law in Australia. Commonwealth versus Yunupingu was about whether the Gumatj clan in the Northern Territory would be entitled to compensation from the Commonwealth for acts that affected their native title rights and interests. The court ultimately found the Gumatj clan was eligible for compensation, holding the Commonwealth liable. The case has been described as one of the most significant tests of native title since the famous Mabo proceedings in 1992. The case originated with the late Yunupingu on behalf of the Gumatj clan of the Yolngu people in northeast Arnhem Land, sought compensation for land subject to bauxite mining in the Gove Peninsula. The clan is seeking an estimated $700 million in compensation as the mining activity winds up, leaving their land damaged. The Crown authorised the mining in the area without the Gumatj clan's consent between the 1930s and the 1960s. The mining lease, originally granted to Nabalco, is now held by Swiss Aluminium and operated by Rio Tinto. Ultimately, the decision by the High Court is significant. It will allow for some acts that have caused profound harms to First Nations people from 1911 to be covered by compensation. This case expands the range of acts for which native title holders could apply for compensation. And the Victorian bail laws are expected to be tightened. The Victorian government is set to implement alterations to bail laws less than a year after they were changed in the wake of a concert after they were changed. They were changed due to the death in custody of an Aboriginal woman. The changes come in the wake of a concerted campaign by conservative media and the police. The laws will treat children like adults in what the government has called the toughest in the country, as though that's something to be proud of. Remanding youth offenders in custody will no longer be a last resort for judges and magistrates. Last week, the Cabinet resolved to finalise changes to the bail laws, which experts have long argued will exacerbate the number of First Nations people spending more time behind bars on remand. Similar laws in New South Wales have seen a significant increase in the number of people denied bail and have been condemned by Indigenous organisations and legal groups. Victoria's Premier, Jacinta Allan, defended the new bail laws, but her words have created a moral panic. The Herald Sun has also led the campaign to have the bail laws tightened.
And the US has carried out dozens of airstrikes on Yemen on Saturday and Sunday, including strikes on residential areas in the densely populated city of Sana'a, killing at least 53 people, including 31 civilians. Anis El Asbahi, a spokesman for the Yemeni Health Ministry, said that over 100 people were wounded, most of whom were children and women. The massacre, a war crime and criminal act of military aggression, was justified by the United States of America as a preemptive strike in response to a statement by Yemen's Houthis last week that they will block Israeli ships from transiting the Red Sea until Israel ceases its blockade of food and water into Gaza. No food, water, fuel or electricity has entered Gaza since March the 2nd, despite a nominal ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights has accused Israel of using starvation as a method of war, which is a war crime. Israel, with the support of the United States, is seeking to starve the population of Gaza, which before the start of the genocide numbered 2 million, in an effort to ethnically cleanse the territory. US President Donald Trump has declared that the United States would seek to own Gaza. On Sunday, the US military carried out more than 40 raids on Yemen, attacking five different provinces. The victims included at least five children and two women, the Houthi Ministry of Health said. Most of the victims were in Sana'a, where the US claimed it was attempting to murder Houthi leaders, itself a war crime. The massacre was the largest military action in the Middle East of the Trump administration to date, and the largest US attack on Yemen in recent years. Over the past year, the United States and Israel have waged a major regional war, coordinated with the Gaza genocide, targeting Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and Iran. As the US continues its military escalation throughout the Middle East, the humanitarian situation in Gaza is deteriorating. Despite the nominal ceasefire, Israel forces continue to kill people in Gaza every single day. On Saturday, an Israeli drone attack killed eight aid workers, among many other casualties on the Gaza Strip. And of course, hostilities in Gaza have increased, attacks and bombings over the last 24 hours.
And continuing in occupied Palestine and Palestine, after over 2 months of imprisonment in Israeli jails, new information has been revealed about Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, the director of Kamal Adwan Hospital in Gaza. According to Palestinian lawyer Qaid Qassem, who visited Dr. Abu Safia last week, he has gone through long periods of sustained interrogation and torture and several prison transfers. Dr. Abu Safia was arrested amid a brutal siege of Kamal Adwan Hospital by Israeli forces, which culminated on December 27th when the Israeli occupation forces set Kamal Adwan Hospital on fire. The IOF also ordered 350 people, including 75 patients and their escorts, along with 185 medical staff, to evacuate the hospital. In the months prior, Dr. Abu Safia had been using his own social media page and giving interviews on local and Western media in order to provide constant updates about Israel's siege of the hospital and pleading for international institutions to take action to stop Israel's attacks. He had become a visible spokesperson for the people of Gaza during the genocide, and in particular, the healthcare workers who have faced disproportionate levels of violence as they struggled to keep the healthcare system online amid Israel's blockade and targeted attacks. While media reports had circulated indicating that Dr. Abu Safia was set to be freed in the final stage of the first phase of the Hamas-Israel prisoners for captives swap deal at the end of February, Israel continues to imprison the hospital director in defiance of the massive international campaign demanding his release. Unshaken by the gross inhumane treatment and torture he suffered, the resilient, iconic Palestinian doctor told Qassem, "A person creates a history, and history is built upon the stands one takes. Such history is to be recorded and taught to others."
And finally, a Nestle worker self-immolates in court after a nine-year battle, igniting a workers' movement for justice. Mohammed Asif Javed Jutt, also known as Asif Jutt, self-immolated on February 25th inside the premises of Pakistan's Lahore High Court in protest against the anti-worker and illegal practices of his former employer, the multinational Nestle Corporation. He succumbed to his injuries in a city hospital a few days later. Jutt worked for Nestle for 16 years before being fired by the management for trying to form a union in 2016. He was terminated despite winning the case in the National Industrial Relations Commission, or the Labour Court. The Labour Court ordered his reinstatement. However, the company management delayed the execution of the order, using claims of faults in the legal procedures and inefficient judicial processes. Using its vast resources, Nestle was able to drag Asif's case on for over 9 years. The years of court battles and lack of alternative employment caused tremendous economic hardship for Jutt and his family. He was forced to sell his home and assets to feed his family and cover the costs of the prolonged legal fight. After years in court with no resolution, Jutt finally lost hope and self-immolated after yet another hearing on February 25th this year. His death caused a spontaneous protest outside the hospital. Since his death, the left parties in the country, led by Hukuk-e-Khalq Party, HKP, and Mazdurkistan Party, MKP, have formed an alliance with civil society and trade union movements to seek justice for Jutt and continue his battle. And those have been the news headlines for Wednesday, 19th of March, 2025.
3CR is radical radio, and that means more than just alternative current affairs and political coverage.
We're radical because we're an independent media outlet owned and operated by the community.
We're radical because we give communities the control of their own shows, with their own music, in their own languages.
We're radical because we provide a media platform for communities to build their own power to create social change.
Become a subscriber and support Radical Radio. Call us on 03 9419 8377 or subscribe online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
And we now have on the line Eddie Kowalski, who is... what's your position with It's Our Voice, Eddie?
I founded that initiative, and we've been working with various groups over the last few years and getting support from universities and so forth to move this project forward.
Excellent. Now, as I said earlier on in the show, we are going to be talking to Eddie about an initiative that he started with another organisation called Conversations at the Crossroads, which helps to bring to life the possibilities of democracy beyond just elections. So, but before we go into that, Eddie, can you tell us about Our Voice a bit?
Well, Our Voice is an initiative that's designed to be a response to what we're seeing as the big challenge, what I consider to be the biggest challenge in front of us, and that is the decline in democracy that is being witnessed globally, the fact that a lot of people feel that they aren't able to have much of an impact in public policy, and that the choices made through the election system are again and again leading to people turning away from politics and not feeling that they're heard and not feeling that the policies that are being created are the ones that they support.
Other than authoritarianism, is there an alternative or is there a supplement to what we currently have?
Well, I think both. I think the supplement is really what we're putting on the table here, which are how can we use technology and potentially some of the tools that have been developed in the market research industry? We know that when we travel, when we shop, when we bank, we have an opportunity to participate both in terms of providing feedback about the products and services we've bought, but also about suggesting how those could be improved. And so we're very intimately potentially involved in those. But when it comes to public policy, we're pretty much most people left out of the picture, and there are no avenues for dialogue and for sitting down and providing our input into those processes. And that's where a lot of great ideas reside, that is within the community. That's the vast majority of expertise lies within the community, not within the ranks of the elected officials. And we have to find ways to bring those together. If we want the best policies to be on the table and for the best potential solutions to the challenges that we face to be discussed, elaborated, and so forth. Now, so, yeah.
I'm being a bit provocative here. Are you saying that letters and petitions aren't enough?
Absolutely, 100%. writing letters to elected officials, you know, what happens to those letters and what a mammoth task those officers have to actually make sense of any of that. We really need to digitise those processes. Letters are not enough. There are a multitude of better alternatives, and those should be put on the table and put on the table quick.
Could you go through some of those?
Well, this is really the area that needs to be explored and, you know, piloted and so forth. So what we've done is we've evaluated what tools exist in the world that could be used to support these objectives. The objective is how do we create policy co-design at scale? This is really an...
Sorry, can I take you back a second? What do you mean by policy co-design?
Well, it's how we, as citizens and elected officials, like we as a society, sit down and design policy responses to the challenges that we face. Co-design is about doing that with together as a collective. And this is an unresolved challenge in terms of how do you do that and include millions of people.
Mm.
It really hasn't been properly solved. So, you know, the avenues that we typically have are go to a referendum. We had one of those. Not a very great experience.
No.
So it's not enough to just vote. There need to be processes that enable people to enter into dialogue, to consider alternative perspectives. And this is called deliberative democracy.
I'm reading a book called Bird Cloud by Annie Proulx. I don't know how you pronounce her surname, I'm afraid. But she talks about deliberative democracy among the native peoples of Turtle Island, North America, and how that was completely misinterpreted by Europeans when they moved there. And it seems like a lot of traditional cultures, they have deep deliberative democracy deeply rooted within their systems and cultures.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, completely agree. And that's what the research shows. If we go even further back into hunter-gatherer time, then those small bands of 100, 150, 200 individuals were all very democratic in their decision-making processes. As we became much larger groups, the ability to actually sit down and come to decisions together is challenged because of space, time, and the ability to all be in the one location. And that's the real fundamental challenge that only technology can help us solve. But we have that now. We are connected. So it's about also building the pathways that allow us to have these conversations.
Although I was also reading an article yesterday, it's quite an old article by somebody called David Reif, arguing that one of the reasons why we don't engage in more deliberation is because it's just too hard and too complicated, and it's difficult work, it's deliberation. Are there ways in which we can get around that? I mean, I was reading that thinking about, you know, the early days of American politics where people would turn up for stump speeches that lasted 3 hours long. Why is it? I can't help feeling that technology is also part of the problem here.
Explain a bit more why you think technology is part of the problem.
Well, because we seem to be having increasingly short attention spans. I mean, having a discussion with you the other day about how we have to keep TikTok videos to a minute if we want people to stay engaged with them. Compare that 100%. To a three-hour stump speech by Lincoln.
Yeah, good point. Very good point. Look, we live in a world that has prioritized engagement. The social media platforms that exist have not been designed for public discourse.
Mm.
They're designed to maximize revenue, which is really because they are profit-maximizing corporations. And as a result, we get what we are seeing in the world, which are a bunch of tools that promote us staying on screen and maximizing screen time, and really are not designed to help us coming together and have civilized conversations. So when we talk about the fact that technology needs to play a role, I think what, you know, we mean is not what we're seeing in the world today. It's more around how can we build upon the infrastructure that exists, that is the connectivity that we have. Mm-hmm. We, you know, we can all connect to one another. What is missing is the means by which we can connect in a profound way that leads to the outcomes that we seek, policy co-design at scale, for example.
Yep.
And so that's the journey that we're on. And there are tools around the world that are pioneering ways of doing this. One of them is a tool that has been built by Stanford University. And so we've been in close touch with them. We've lined up a partnership to work together to pilot the use of their platform here in Australia for a discussion that can then include any number of Australians that wish to participate in any policy conversation or topic.
And when you say any number of Australians, do you have a sort of figure in mind of how many you'd like to see participating?
Well, one of the big challenges that I see right now is that people are alienated from the political processes and have lost faith in them completely. So one of the ways to address that is to create avenues that allow anyone and everyone who wishes to participate to do so. And I think we need to work our way up to the point where millions of Australians are joining in one conversation or another, or offering feedback in one way, shape or form or another. So I don't want to put a cap. Like, I think the more people that we can support in having a voice and being able to be included, the better it is for them and for society at large.
So tell us a bit about what's being organised.
So the online citizens assembly that we're organising is designed to pilot a way to bring people together into a deliberation that is uncapped and that allows anyone in Australia who wishes to do so to join the conversation. And we've picked a topic that is quite, discussed in the media and so forth. But it's not just about that topic. In fact, the topic doesn't really matter. It's about
Maybe tell us what the topic is anyway.
Yeah, of course. we think it'll be good to have a national discussion around the nuclear power proposal that's being put on the table. And therefore, that's the topic for the first one of these exercises, or the first policy discussion that we're organising. And really, to stress, the view is that we really want to have these conversations on many different topics. And it's not about the topic itself. It's about creating the space that is designed to allow people from different perspectives with different ideas, ideologies, but also life experience to contribute those and find ways of actually bringing all of that together so that, you know, in a way, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, if you will, that we have something that leads to something quite superior.
And could you just describe how the process is going to actually work?
Well, there's, yes, of course. There will be a number of events online that are made available to Australians to actually join at different times. So we're going to run, we have in mind three sessions so that we can accommodate people with different availabilities. And the way that the actual conversation goes is that they will be invited and broken into groups of about 10 Australians. And within those groups, they'll be able to discuss their experiences, their perspectives, and also hear from others. And that's the process for the deliberation, which then will lead to a report that we will work with Stanford University on producing, which is going to analyse and understand what people have been discussing, and then have a final view on that. There will also be surveys. So we have already created a registration survey that allows people to indicate what their current views are before they enter any of these discussions. And that's another pathway for them to get involved. And we may do more surveys along the way, including at the end of the process. And there likely is also going to be an online discussion space that we open up to allow people between now and when the whole event concludes to actually discuss with each other anything relating to the topic at any time that suits them. So we're trying various pathways and using a collection of tools to achieve the desired goal.
And if people are interested, where can they find out more information? We'll put a link in the show notes as well.
Sure. They can go to itsourvoice.com.
Great. And there's a button, a big purple button there where you can register your interest if you're interested in taking part in this process. Very quickly, what will happen to the results of the deliberation?
Oh, very good question. So this is, again, the part that we hope we can, over time, build partnerships with media outlets, and our view is that media has a big role to play in supporting what we're doing and also creating further dialogue around what is being discussed in these deliberative groups. And so we will use the outputs from these processes, the reports, the findings, the conclusions that we draw, and we will be sharing those both with all the participants, the elected officials, and members of the media.
Great.
So we hope to amplify or, you know, project or share the views of Australians, you know, with the rest of the community.
Great. Thank you very much for your time this morning, Eddie, getting up so bright and early. That was Eddie Kowalski from Our Voice talking about an online initiative to bring Australians and my understanding is that includes anybody that's living in Australia together to talk about the proposed plan to build nuclear power stations across Australia. Shall we go to a song? Shall we go to a community announcement? What have you got lined up for us, Marty?
We can do both.
Oh.
We could do a community announcement and then a song. I think that's the way we go.
Okay. And you're listening to 855 AM, 3CR, Wednesday Breakfast.
3CR Community Radio is dedicated to exploring the issues that affect our future.
Because I think it is something we just need to be talking about.
855 AM. Tune in and listen up.
I might be a little bit behind the times being out of town for a week, but did you guys see or hear any of the news about the Irish band Kneecap, who were in town last week?
I saw a lot about them on the news, on social media, and the most fun part was when they brought the
King's head
on stage.
Okay, I think you get where I was going. I was curious about that. That was one part of it. That was interesting. Yeah.
Hmm.
That was nearly a week ago now, but also a big gathering in Fed Square. Obviously, attracted a lot of people. But
yeah.
That
and a lot of Palestinian flags as well. Among the people there.
Very cool.
Yeah, fascinating band. Let's have a listen to one of their tracks.
Cool.
And that was Kneecap. Excellent Irish music. Get the Brits out get your Brits out, I should say. Unfortunately, I didn't get to make it to the gigs.
I saw him down at Golden Plains a couple of weekends ago. It was very entertaining.
Energetic.
Very energetic, yes.
So you're listening to Wednesday Breakfast. It's 7:35 a.m. on 855 a.m. dial on the online service at 3cr.org.au. And you could be listening on the playback service or in the air, and always everyone in the future. Hi, hope everything's well in the future.
Hi there.
So now we're going to our next interview with Marcus Rubenstein. So Marcus is an independent journalist with more than 25 years of media experience, having previously been a staffer with the Federal Liberal Party senator from 92 to 94, spent 5 years at 7 News in Sydney, 7 years at SBS World News, where he was a senior correspondent. And I could go on, but also Marcus, I know you're an amazing photographer, and you're also the editor of Australian business news website APAC, and also a regular contributor to Pearls and Irritations Journal, which is where I've found you. Good morning, Marcus. How are you?
Morning, Jesse. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks so much for coming on. I know you've written for Pearls and Irritations a few years back, I believe, but you've recently returned with a regular column titled Anti-China Media Watch. That's right.
Yeah, that's correct.
Awesome. So perhaps we could start by asking about your experience with China. I know you've traveled there quite a lot over the years, and maybe I can ask you why China, and also why, why Anti-China Media Watch?
Look, going back to my interest in China, I guess it goes back to my family. My father worked for a company which sold medical equipment. It was an American company that sold medical equipment right throughout Asia, so throughout Southeast Asia and North Asia, so everywhere from, I guess, Vietnam to working your way eastward to Japan, so you name it, Singapore, Malaysia, the Philippines, Indonesia, South Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and China. So I was always exposed to Asian culture as a kid growing up, and I always thought it was a pretty natural part of the world in which we lived. I mean, Australia is very much, we're in the same time zone as most of Asia, so I figured we were, you know, very much part of that extended Southeast Asian archipelago, for want of a better expression. I started traveling to China probably about, 16 years ago was my first trip to the mainland. Probably 30 years ago I first went to Hong Kong. And it's just a country that fascinates me. I think the first thing that I learned about China was that it was quite an advanced nation that had a very good story to tell. And mind you, this is close to 20 years ago. They were just very, very bad at telling it.
Mm. Yeah, definitely here as well, especially. So, and what was the idea behind the anti-China Media Watch column?
It's something I'd built up with John Menadue, who's the founder of Pearls and Irritations. John has had a distinguished career in public service. He was Gough Whitlam's principal private secretary when Gough was opposition leader in the early 1970s.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And when Gough won the 1972 election, he appointed John as the secretary of the Prime Minister's Department, which is now the Prime Minister and Cabinet. And he stayed on until Gough's dismissal in November 75. And then when when Malcolm Fraser became Prime Minister after the 75 election, John stayed on as head of the Prime Minister's Department, and Fraser eventually appointed him Australia's ambassador to Japan. So John's interest in China, or in Asia rather, goes back almost 60 years now, mm-hmm. Certainly into the as far back as the late 1960s. The Pearls and Irritations is a public policy journal which challenges, the conventional or contemporary theory on public policy. And one of those key areas is our foreign and military policy. It has a pretty strong stand against AUKUS, and these are sort of the nuances that the mainstream media and the politicians escape. I think listeners would have quite probably been aware of Malcolm Turnbull's criticism this week of AUKUS, and who now joins Paul Keating and being quite vocal against that. Whether you agree with the US alliance or not, AUKUS is just it's a dud deal. We've committed $368 billion of taxpayers' money, and nowhere in the AUKUS agreement do the Americans have to actually guarantee delivering a submarine. Mm. It's quite possible we spend the bulk of that money and never see a submarine. Yeah. So these are the kinds of issues, and one of the issues is why do we have do we invest money in things such as AUKUS? And that's because the supposed threat of China. Mm. Australia annoys China. America threatens China, and not in somewhat of a military threat, but mainly an economic threat. Mm. This is the world in which we live. And because views are so polarized these days, that people who question China's policies and motives, they tend to go to the extreme and say, well, China's just doing terrible things everywhere. So that was the idea behind this column. So I look at reports on mainstream media reports on on China and Chinese-related matters, Chinese-Australians, and just try to give them a bit of perspective.
Mm. Thank you. So I guess the way I see it is, you know, there is, of course, a lot of anti-China reporting in across all, maybe not all, but most of Australian media. And I guess I see it as a kind of manufacturing of consent for potential war, hopefully not, but at least economic subjugation and justifying that, you know, all the sanctions and tariffs and all this stuff, which is just bizarre because, you know, Australia and China have a lot of benefits from having good economic relations to be had. And I was wondering, you know, if you would be able to tell us a bit about the bigger forces at play here, who's kind of involved. And I know you've written quite a bit about ASPI previously, and I was hoping you could tell us a bit about who they are.
Well, ASPI or ASPI, or the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, is a think tank which was formed in 2001 by the Howard government, and John Howard was hands-on in its formation. And the idea behind it was that Australian defence policy had become a bit staid, and it was very much concentrated in policy formation within a few groups inside defence and inside the government. And these things don't always work well. I mean, I digress a little bit, but at the by the end of the Vietnam War, certainly in the dying throes of the Vietnam War, the United States Army had more aircraft than the United States Air Force. It had more aircraft than any air force in the world. And the reason they had more aircraft is because the United States Air Force was not interested in winning the Vietnam War. They were interested in getting billions and billions of dollars from Congress so they could build supersonic jet fighters in a supposed, you know, World War III against the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. which of course never eventuated. So this is how militaries operate. So that was the idea behind ASPI. And it did that under its founding executive director, a guy called Professor Hugh White. It did its job for a few years. Then along comes a guy called Peter Jennings, who was their longest-serving executive director. Peter became executive director around about 2010, if I'm not mistaken. And Jennings basically started to commercialize ASPI, where it was originally getting about $3 million in government funding to produce research papers on the best strategies for Australia's defense, to all of a sudden being a critic of Australia's adversaries. And it started getting on board sponsorships, so it would do events, it would write papers, and it was having a whole host of American and European weapons manufacturers as its sponsors. So, surprise, surprise, they started advocating for, I mean, probably their most famous one was they were advocating for the purchase of French submarines in and around 2014, 2015, when the 2016, I think the deal was beginning to be negotiated and struck then, and the major contributor was to that French submarine contract was a company called Thales, and the Thales was a.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Of course, an ASPI sponsor, so they were just effectively acting as a lobby group. And then the China narrative came along and they started collecting money from the United States State Department. Now, if you go through and you can find these documents because the National Archives releases them after 20 years, and I've been into the archives, I've looked at the cabinet papers, the discussions as to the formation of ASPE, and there was nothing in it that said it could run around and get sponsored dollars and it could get funded from foreign governments. And that funding is substantial. In the US government alone has tipped more than $10 million into the coffers of ASPE, yeah. Which it admits is primarily for the purpose of producing reports that paint China as a military threat to Australia and the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And as you said, manufacturing consent, it's effectively become a propaganda tool of the US government and US foreign policy interests.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for explaining that, Marcus. So look, I'm really sorry we're running out of time. We've packed our show this morning, but it would be great if, you know, maybe one day we can speak a bit more in the future. But for anyone who's interested in reading more, learning more about the kinds of things you're speaking about, where can people find out more about it?
I guess there's lots of places to go. Probably the best is the Pearls and Irritations, which is the website is John Menadue, M-E-N-A-D-U-E. But if you just Google John Menadue, Pearls and Irritations will pop up at the top of the Google results. But there's a lot of interesting material there. And I guess just look for alternative media. There's some great people on Twitter. Caitlin Johnson is great on Twitter. She has a lot of stuff. Declassified Australia is great. And any independent media. Independent media is really doing their job in Australia, and the mainstream media is not. So, you know, things like 3CR, you've got to look for alternative sources of news because that's where the analysis is coming from in this point in time.
Thanks so much, Marcus, and I hope you have a great day.
Thanks, Jesse. Have a great day to you and your listeners as well.
Thank you. And that was Marcus Rubenstein, who is the author of the Anti-China Media Watch column on Pearls and Irritations, among many other things. But yeah, excellent analysis from and knowledge, as you can hear, from Marcus. So have a look on Google. And in the show notes, yes.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
And we now have on the line, this is a packed show, we're racing from one guest to another. Thank you for being on hold, Brad. We've got Brad Homewood on the line. Thanks for joining us, Brad. As I said earlier in the show, you've spent 2 months serving a prison sentence for blocking the Westgate Bridge for climate. Thank you for doing that. And you're speaking tonight at the Defend Dissent Coalition rally. Can you tell us a bit about why you're speaking tonight?
Oh, look, thank you. Thank you for fitting me in and on a busy morning. We got together in early January when we were trying to have a bit of a break, as most activists do, and decided that we had needed to push back on these new repressive anti-protest laws that the state government had announced late last year. So we got together a coalition. We reached out to all our networks and put together a very broad coalition from the street movement on the streets of Naam. We're building power to push back against these anti-protest laws is the short answer to that question. We know, you know, First Nations people in this country have experienced state repression, brutal state repression for hundreds of years, but we've seen a trend in recent years where governments around the country have started to dial it up against the rest of us as well. So, you know, we can take the easy path and we can just... let them get away with it and let them have a win, or we can stand up to it and we can lean into these new laws and we can push back and hopefully get them to retreat in some way.
Why do you think that they're pushing these laws? I mean, protest is a bit of a waste of time, right?
Yeah, well, a lot of people might have seen that great reel that's been doing the rounds on social media from Richard Dennis from the Australia Institute, where he said, you know, we know protest works because they're trying to clamp down on it. And really, this is a sign of success. This is a credit to the street movement. It's a credit to the climate and environmental movement. It's a credit to the peace and free Palestine movement and the first the movement for First Nations justice. Because if we weren't having an impact as a protest movement, they wouldn't feel the need to dial up the repression. That's the cut and dry of it, really. So to answer your question more directly, I think what we're seeing is the state government are giving in to the foreign influence of the Zionist lobby. They're giving in to the largely foreign influence of the fossil fuel industry, and they're giving in to the usual repressive nonsense from Victoria Police, let's be honest, because they've been complaining about lock-on devices and glue and things like that for years now, and that's also part of the legislation.
So maybe just tell us what the legislation is actually going to restrict. I did do a brief run through earlier, but I'm sure that you can tell us more details.
Okay, so they want to introduce a ban on wearing masks, which is interesting because for a number of years now we've been told we have to wear COVID masks, but you know, very solid medical reasons. So a ban on wearing masks at protests, restrictions on symbols of resistance, including flags and tools such as, you know, locks, ropes, glue, you know, all the devices that some within the protest movement have been using successfully for some time now. They want to introduce what they call a social cohesion pledge for multicultural organisations that receive funding from the government. In other words, you're not allowed to criticise Israel. Really disturbing other aspect of this is they want to introduce safe zones around places of worship and religious buildings. So somebody also released a tile on social media a couple of months ago, and they showed just in the city how many places of worship there are, and if all these zones came in, how many parts of the city you just wouldn't be able to protest in. And it would almost shut down the protest movement and give the police even more power to repress protest movement. So we simply have to push back on this. And the irony of this too, in their press release, when they released the statement, they said that these lock-on devices, quote, make heroes out of morons. That's what they actually said. That's the wording. And this is the same state Labor Party that funded the building of the statue of the feminist icon Zelda DiPrano, who literally locked onto a federal building to demand equal pay for women. So I don't know if there's a little bit of revisionism going on here, and they're now calling Zelda DiPrano a moron. But, yeah, you know, it's just completely nonsensical, and we have to stand up to it, and we hope everyone turns up tonight, everyone who can make it, because we really need to make this big, and it certainly won't be the last of it.
And can you tell us a bit about what's planned for this evening?
Oh, look, we have a great list of speakers. Lydia Thorpe will be speaking. Gabrielle Devetrios will be speaking. We'll be starting at the state parliament, and we'll be marching from there, and we will end up at the statue of Zelda DiPrano at Trades Hall. So
excellent.
Yeah.
And just one last question. Who's in the Defend Dissent Coalition? Could you give us a sort of rundown of the diversity of groups involved?
Yeah, look, we've been, you know, it was a small group of us that started in January, and we've been thrilled by the take-up. There's, you know, a lot of the typical climate environmental groups, but, you know, we also got Warriors of the Aboriginal Resistance, we've got Rahu, we've got Anti-Orcas, we've got some COVID safety groups in there. It's just, it's a really broad spectrum of the street movement. Friends of the Earth, Extinction Rebellion, Blockade Australia, Refugee Action Collective. It's just really broad and a great cross-representation. And this is what they don't realise, you know. The street movement, we can have our differences on theories of change and tactics and all these sorts of things. There are little things that might divide us at times, but the one thing that unites us all is our right to protest. And the one thing these new proposed laws has done has brought us all together. I think that's a classic example of
biting the hand that feeds you kind of thing, only in a good way.
Yeah, exactly. And We're building great new work networks and making great new friendships too, and that just makes us stronger as a street movement.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Brad. I think that's probably about all that we've got time for. But if people want to find out more information, where can they go?
If your group hasn't already signed up and you want to sign up, or you're an individual and you want to get involved, you can go to Defend Dissent Coalition on both Instagram and Facebook, and you can reach us that way. Or you can turn up this afternoon, 5:30 at the State Parliament, and this won't be the last of it either.
No. Well, hopefully it will mean that we get the laws overturned, or, you know, not passed through Parliament, and we won't need to protest on this particular issue for a while.
Exactly. And look, I should mention, I've neglected to mention,
sure,
we are launching a petition. If we can get 2,000 signatures, then they have to debate it in the Parliament. So there'll be people getting around with boards and petitions. So if you are there, please just take a little bit of time to sign that, and then we can force a debate in the Parliament as well.
Great. And is there an online petition as well? Because we could put a link in the show notes to that.
I'm pretty sure there is.
I'll see if I can find it.
On the social media, yeah.
Great. Thanks a lot for joining us, Brad. And good luck this afternoon.
Thank you very much for your time, and have a great day, everyone.
Thank you too. Bye.
Bye.
That was Brad Homewood, an Extinction Rebellion activist who spent 2 months serving a prison sentence for halting traffic on the Westgate Bridge.
Yeah, it's great. There's plenty there to think about, isn't there?
Yeah. And I mean, just a quick, as someone who comes from a country where there have been, you know, really draconian anti-protest laws, I really was quite shocked and scared by the proposals that are on the table, because it feels like we're getting more and more towards that authoritarian state control here. And I mean, the way that we discussed last week about the clampdown on freedom of speech and things like that. So I think it's, yeah, really important for everyone to show up.
If some of those things were ushered in without people really realising it's happening, only to be sort of smacked in the face when they can't do what they want to do.
Yeah.
Yes.
And there's the police special powers thing that's being snuck through as well, I was hearing just now. So keep eye open for that, for an increase in police powers.
I was looking over some of the 3CR AM guides. So if any listeners don't know, you can go online and check out the guides. It has a run through of some of the programs that we have and interviews with some of the programmers and hosts. But there was some kind of articles in some of the older guides that, I guess, somewhat sadly or unfortunately, they were very, 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 very similar to, you know, what we're talking about today.
Yeah.
Same sorts of things, but I suppose, you know, it just seems to be on a very clear downward trend.
Well, I think it's also about the cycle of protests and when it's successful and when it's when there's less protests happening. We're currently seeing a huge upsurge. I mean, because we're facing, you know, the multi-crisis, the poly-crisis that we're in at the moment, we're seeing an upsurge in protest against that. And so I think that when people are taking power to themselves and to as a collective, then you're going to see the pushback. And I think the pushback is a sign of a growing ferment
absolutely
at the grassroots.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just gone 8 o'clock. You're listening to 3CR Radical Radio. We'll be back in just a minute, or half a minute.
3CR Community Radio is dedicated to exploring the issues that affect our future.
Because I think it is something we just need to be talking about.
855 AM. Tune in and listen up.
Good morning. It's 8:01 a.m. and you're on 3CR. We just listened to an interview with Defend Dissent Coalition. Previous to that, we listened to an interview with the author of the Australia-China Media Watch, Marcus Rubenstein. And next we are going to go to a song, and this song is called Bunduki Zakwetu, and it was written by Delphin Katembo Vinyuasiki, known professionally as Delcat Andiko, who was a Congolese musician who was shot and killed on the 13th of February this year in Goma in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. His death occurred just hours after releasing his final song, Bunduki Zakwetu, which translates to Our Guns in English. And he was murdered while filming its music video. Known as the voice of the people, Delcat created music that criticized those exploiting Congo's resources at the expense of its citizens. His final song specifically condemned the occupation of Goma by Rwandan defense forces, which are backed by Western powers, including the US, the UK, France, and the European Union, through their proxy group M23. His assassination is viewed as a warning to other Congolese citizens who might speak out against these forces. The killing took place amid an escalating conflict in North Kivu province that has claimed over 9,000 lives since January of this year, displaced hundreds of thousands, and destroyed livelihoods. This ongoing conflict is largely driven by competition for Congo's valuable land and natural resources. So we'll now listen to Bunduki Zakwetu. And we have just been listening to a song by Congolese musician Delcat Andiko, so called Bunduki Zakwetu, which translates to Our Guns. And the singer of the song was unfortunately assassinated for producing this song and other political music.
And now we'll head to second part of an interview I did with Sasha Gillies-Lakakis, who is an incredible mind and just a library of knowledge of all things Latin America and surrounds. Sasha Gillies-Lakakis is also a co-host of Latin American Update here on 3CR, as well as the Unitarian Half Hour, and a regular contributor to Tuesday Home Time and lots of other programs. So he's probably a familiar voice because, yeah, he's just incredible knowledge. So I felt very lucky to take some of his time to talk about Cuba. And in the last part, we spoke about the history of colonization and then the movement for independence. And we continue from there.
And basically, the US implemented this system, which in Cuba was known as la botella, or the bottle, which basically implied that each member of the Cuban elite would take a sip of the bottle, aka bribes from the United States, to do whatever the United States wanted them to do. And that essentially meant maintaining the plantation economy, but you're replacing Spanish companies with American companies. And also, you know, building up a lot of this strategic infrastructure that the US continues to use in Cuba, for example, Guantanamo Bay. That happened in the early 1900s. That lease, which is it's a 100-year lease that gets renewed every 100 years, or that's the idea. And the Cubans had, you know, no say over this. Their elite handlers were simply handing off territory. They then signed the Platt Amendment as well in 1902, which essentially granted the United States full control over Cuban banks and also over Cuban foreign policy. So any decision that the Cuban Congress made, this so-called independent Cuban Congress that the United States disagreed with, the US could simply nullify that decision. And the Cubans had no power over that. So this was not a true independence. This was what the Cubans today call the period of the neo-colony, because that's what Cuba became. It was independent in name. It was officially the Republic of Cuba, but it was ruled by all of these satraps that were basically controlled by Washington through bribes, through blackmail, or, you know, simply through their allegiance to the United States, because they were perfectly happy to sell off their country's assets. Most of the island, by the time that the Cuban Revolution came around, wasn't even owned by Cubans. It was owned by wealthy Americans, in some cases some Spanish who had chosen to stay behind and who were wealthy enough to basically rebuild their fortune. But mostly it was American companies, you know, the Hershey Sugar Company from the United States. The only rail infrastructure on the island was built by the Hershey Rail Company to transport sugar from plantations direct to ports. So it didn't even service the Cuban population. And throughout this period, this 50-year period, really, from, you know, 1902 up until, you know, the 1950s, when we have the revolution in 59, we just see Cuba sink further and further, you know, into this you know, very, very sad state. You know, sugar prices collapse during the Great Depression. So, you know, the wages in Cuba just plummet to, you know, lower than they already were. And most people weren't getting proper wages to begin with. You saw no attempt to diversify the economy to try and make it more competitive, to try and move it towards a more industrialized sort of footing, which a lot of other countries in Latin America were doing at this time. But of course, Cuba wasn't. Cuba was simply providing sugar for the United States market, and then a little bit of coffee, which grew in popularity as well. And, you know, you have constant uprisings throughout this period. You even have a much smaller revolution, actually, that a lot of people don't know about in 1933, which was against General Machado, who was a Cuban general politician who was widely reviled in Cuba, but he was a U.S. puppet who ruled for about 15 years. And he was overthrown in 1933 by a combination of very, very dynamic agitation by trade unions, the Cuban Trade Union Central, which is what it's called, the Cuban Communist Party, which came into being at this time as well and was very active, and a number of smaller revolutionary cells, one of which, the M26 movement, which would eventually become the movement that Fidel Castro led. But at this stage, it was a much smaller part of the Cuban working class movement. But, you know, there was this very dynamic sort of agitation and resistance to what the US-backed elites were doing. And once Machado was overthrown in 1933, we had, again, another member of the Cuban elite, Grau San Martin, come to power, who was a little bit more forward-thinking. He made concessions to this movement. He implemented a new constitution that was a lot more progressive, implemented workers' rights, or enshrined them officially. You know, the degree to which that trickled down is, you know, not quite as you know, realistic as the sort of aspirations. But also, sadly, again, you know, his entire mandate was reliant on the Cuban military basically allowing him to do this. And it got to a point where the Cuban military and the US were thinking he was getting a little bit too big for his boots. And he was overthrown by none other than Fulgencio Batista, who is, of course, the most well-known of the US vassals in Cuba. And under Batista, who was a sergeant, he wasn't even a general. He didn't have any real combat experience at all to speak of. But of course, he elevated himself to the level of colonel without any sort of, you know, real due process. And we begin to really see this slide into Cuba becoming a pit for organized crime. You know, from 1940, when he takes power the first time, right up until the Cuban Revolution. And, you know, this is where the excesses of the neo-colony really sort of reach their peak, where we see Cuba becomes the number one destination for drug trafficking in the Americas. It has higher per capita cocaine use than the United States at this time, which, you know, which is awful to think, you know, that just the degree of drug use, substance addiction that would have ravaged Cuba at that time. Of course, prostitution, you know, very degrading commercialized sex work that basically just serviced American tourists. Very, very awful, degrading work, explosion of sexually transmitted infections, diseases, all of these sorts of associated health issues, and of course, gambling as well. Cuba just became a money laundering machine. Americans would come over and, you know, basically use Cuba to launder their money or just to gamble, because it was banned in the United States during the Prohibition period. And, you know, most Cubans are living in misery. You know, they're living in mud huts and shacks on the outskirts of Havana. The rural areas are even more dire. You know, there's no semblance of, you know, social services, public works, anything like that. The situation was awful, and everything was just centered around these sugar plantations and these sugar refineries. So that was the only source of wealth. And, you know, if you could get a job in these refineries, these US sugar refineries, you got a little bit more money, you know, compared to just being a beggar or unemployed. But, you know, the work was grueling. You were working 10 to 15 hours a day in the blistering tropical heat, the humidity. And, you know, a lot of the time these people weren't paid properly either, even though officially, you know, these people had a minimum wage in this new constitution. And, you know, what you had was most Cubans saw this situation for what it was, that this wasn't a true independence, and that the United States, just like Martí had said, had provided false promises to the Cubans that, you know, this U.S. tutelage was just basically Spain 2.0, you know, for all intents and purposes. And the U.S., you know, was always happy to use violence to put down people, to put down movements, riots, protests, just like the Spanish did, killed a lot of people, jailed a lot of people. And what we have, though, in 1953 is an assault on what is called the Moncada Barracks, which is in Santiago de Cuba, which is on the other side of the island, the eastern side. And it fails. It was a pretty poorly planned military operation. A lot of them, the members of that group that launched the attack, were captured. And of course, amongst these people were Che Guevara and Raul Castro and Fidel Castro. And this is the movement that would become the M26 movement, the Movimiento 26 de Julio, the 26th of July movement, named after the day, the 26th of July, when they attacked the Moncada barracks, because this is widely regarded as the start of the Cuban Revolution. Even though the revolution triumphs in 1959, this sort of opening salvo by the revolutionaries begins in 53. And Fidel Castro had moved throughout a lot of different, revolutionary movements, the Communist Party, the trade union movement, and then, this much smaller armed insurrectionist movement that became M26. It didn't really have a name before that. It was sort of just, a little cell of, of activists, of revolutionaries. And Castro himself was a very, very interesting individual because he did come from a relatively well-off family in Biran, in eastern Cuba, which is a small town. His father was a sugar plantation owner. It was much smaller than the more, large scale plantations, but he came from relatively well off roots. But, he always was widely read, Fidel Castro. He studied law at the University of Havana, a very, very, very intelligent individual. And he would spend his free time going around to the poor neighborhoods of Havana when he was a student, talking with people. This is what radicalized him. And, a lot of his peers didn't do this, but he was the one who went out to the poorer neighborhoods, to the mud shacks, out to rural areas, and he spoke with people and he understood their grievances. And he combined this practical experience with his readings of people like José Martí to articulate, this sort of revolutionary program, this revolutionary consciousness. And, he was extremely charismatic, even in his older years before he died, he was, regardless of whether you liked him or not, people acknowledged he was very charismatic. So he drew all of these movements together. By the time we see Fidel Castro launch, the second salvo of, this revolutionary insurrection in 1955, when there are a lot more people who have joined this M26 movement, he's drawn hundreds of thousands of people to his banner. We've got cells popping up in every province in Cuba. There's three different fronts in this campaign against the Batista regime. There's the eastern side, which is led by Fidel himself. There's the central campaign, which is in the center of the island where most of the sugar plantations are, which is led by Che Guevara. And then the far western side of the island on the other side of Havana was led by Raul Castro. And they essentially all converged. It eventually became unstoppable. The Batista regime sort of collapsed in on itself because, it was really only held together by bribes, by, blackmail against, and within these circles of generals. It was a very unstable regime. And these three prongs essentially converged on Havana. And, by the time that they reached Havana, they virtually marched in there unopposed. Batista fled on a US plane to the Dominican Republic, took a large part of the Cuban treasury with him and his cronies, but he fled. He fled and, this Batista regime collapsed. And in 1959, on the 1st of January, he declares the triumph. Fidel Castro declares the triumph of the Cuban Revolution to a crowd of 1 million Cubans in Havana at the time where the population was about 1.5 million. So, two-thirds of the city came out to see him. There's pictures and videos of this, where he's in the Plaza de la Revolución, the Revolution Plaza, and it's just filled. All of the side arteries, leading out from it are filled by people. And, at this stage, he doesn't declare that it's an explicitly socialist revolution. It's more, a Cuban nationalist revolution. But, when he starts talking about policies, when he talks about universalizing education, healthcare, nationalizing and expropriating the foreign-owned land and the foreign-owned firms, it becomes pretty clear that this is the only direction it could go, in a socialist direction, because that's ultimately what it was. And Fidel Castro himself, he recognized this. He recognized that, you know, freeing Cuba from the US orbit was, you know, was one thing, but achieving a sort of genuine revolution and a genuine development for Cuba required something else that, you know, those earlier revolutionaries hadn't come up with. Of course, socialism was a very, very young concept back in that time, hadn't filtered out to Latin America very much at all. So, you know, now with this, you know, the Russian Revolution had happened in 1917, you had the victory over fascism in World War II, you know, chiefly by the Red Army. And, you know, Fidel Castro looked to these examples and saw, you know, that this was a program that could be applied to Cuba. So I think, you know, if we want to look at the history, that is the general trajectory of Cuban history, that in Cuba today it's seen as a three-stage liberation struggle. You know, we had the first war in 68 against the Spanish. We had then the second war in 1895, which again was fought against Spain. And then, you know, America intervened and sort of scuppered that independence. And then we had the final, you know, achievement of true sovereignty, you know, the final phase in 1959, which was the socialist revolution.
And that was the second part of a multi-part interview I did with Sasha Gillies-Lukakis, who is the co-host of Latin American Update here on 3CR, which you can listen to on Sundays from 10:30 to 11. And also his voice will appear on many other programs here. And one thing that sort of stood out to me there is, you know, knowledge is power. And yeah, that's what I get from Sasha. Yeah, so we'll be moving on to a track, I think, Marty.
Yes, a couple of quick minutes of power from Melbourne's mighty Private Function. Here we go. All right, Private Function, Melbourne band Private Function, just having a geeze. And congratulations to them too for their excellent support slots with American band Green Day, supporting them around the country. So a huge effort.
And now we'll go to a few community announcements, starting with today's.
Today's Defend Dissent Coalition protest. For those of you who have just woken up and haven't heard us going on about this all through the show, there is a rally today at State Parliament at 5:30 to defend the right to protest. Please do get along, because this might be otherwise your last opportunity.
Okay, good point.
Yes. Yeah, that's very important. And on Saturday, there is a free Palestine Dandenong public meeting. That's at 11 a.m. at the market in Dandenong. And then later on Saturday, there is also a forum, Sri Lanka at Crossroads at the Democritus Cultural Centre at 3 p.m. That's in Northcote.
On Sunday at... Ooh, what time is it? 10:30 in the morning. There is a March for Native Forests outside MP Peter Khalil's office, which is 466 to 468 Sydney Road. And that's, I mean, what it says on the tin, to protect native forests and to stop logging in them.
And also on Sunday at Black Spark, there is an educational discussion with an optional language sharing after, which is hosted by Anak Bayan Melbourne. And they're a Filipino excellent social activists group. This educational discussion is focusing on Philippine society and revolution, and also regarding Duterte's recent ICC arrest and the Filipino people's ongoing struggles under the US-led Marcos regime.
And perhaps time for a show rundown. Would you like to start, Jesse?
Sure. So the last one we heard from the interview I had with Sasha Gillies-Lukakis regarding the history of Cuba, moving through the original colonization and independence movement, and then on through to the US involvement.
And before that, we were talking with Brad Homewood, and that was about the Defend Dissent protest, which, in case you missed it, is happening tonight, this afternoon at 5:30 outside the State Parliament. He's an Extinction Rebellion activist who spent 2 months in prison for locking on at the Westgate Bridge to draw attention to the climate crisis.
Very inspirational. And prior to that, I had an interview with Marcus Rubenstein, who is a journalist, independent journalist, and also a weekly column called Anti-China Media Watch, which is on the public policy journal Pearls and Irritations. And we spoke about his column, basically, and China and the way that Australian media is manufacturing consent for hostilities with China, really.
And our first interview of the morning, way back at 7:15, was with Eddie Kowalski talking about deliberative democracy and an online event on nuclear power, which is being organised, and inviting everyone to participate in a massive online deliberation exercise. Mm. And that's it for us this morning. Coming up next is Stick Together. Thank you to all our guests. Thank you to everyone in the studio.
Yes, thank you. Nice to be in the room with you all.
And thank you to all our listeners.
Thanks, listeners.
Thank you. Have a great day, all.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.